For investors in this or any niche, data is one of the most important factors to making great investing decisions. But how can you keep up with all the relevant data that you need to be an effective real estate investor? Today's episode with Neil Bawa is a data goldmine for any real estate investor. And in this 20-minute episode, you'll learn some of the key federal and local metrics that the best of the best investors pay close attention to. And as a bonus, you'll learn a ton about how to win through our up-and-coming recession. This is Building Passive Income and Wealth Through Real Estate, where we guide you through the relentless pursuit of financial independence. I'm your host, Justin Moy, managing partner at Perpetual Wealth Capital, a multifamily real estate investing firm that lets everyday people invest passively in income-producing apartment buildings. Hey, investors. Welcome back to another episode of the show. Now, today, I am extremely excited to have Neil Bawa as our guest. Now, Neil is a technologist who is universally known in the real estate game as the mad scientist of multifamily. He's a data guru, one of the most in-demand speakers on the topics of investing, multifamily, and anytime data or any trends are coming up. He's also a host of Multifamily University, which I'm not sure if it's on multiple platforms, but I watch it on YouTube. And Neil is a goldmine of information for this field. So Neil, we are extremely excited to have you here on the show with us.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me on the show. Very excited to be here, especially in these strange and turbulent times.
Yeah, in these trying times is what a lot of people like to say. And so, you know, the way that we like to do on the show, I like to get right into it. I want to hit you with the question. I'm sure you've been getting kind of a lot, but a lot of people are out there asking it. Neil, are we in a bubble? And is this bubble about to burst on us?
Well, so I'll define it as, is the multifamily bubble about to burst? The short answer is no. And there are so many different reasons for that. There's an economic reason. There's a geopolitical reason. There is a cash on the sidelines reason. What we are about to see, and I think we are already seeing in the last month, is a decline in multifamily prices on a per door basis. That decline's very small, and it's because rents are increasing so fast. So we are going to see a decline in multifamily prices in Q3 of this year. So Q2 has ended. There was no decline. There was no increase in prices on a per door basis. There was no decrease. So it was flat. But we are going to see a decrease in prices. A bubble, though, is a different creature. A bubble is when you get into an environment where prices are in free fall. They're falling because there's a lot more sellers than buyers. That simply is not a description of today's multifamily market. The description continues to be a lot more buyers than sellers, but prices are adjusting because they have to, because our net operating income after including debt service is going down because our debt service is increasing because of interest rates.
And so you feel at this price, whatever people like to use, some people say adjustment or correction, or there are people who do say that that's the bubble and it's going to all come crashing down. Is that NOI holding steady or possibly decreasing predominantly because of that debt service? Because we have seen interest rates shoot up and then there's some signs that they're coming back down as well. Once those interest rates, if they do start coming back down, are we going to see the same thing, or are rental prices actually decreasing, like top line income decreasing? Because a lot of people feel that in some markets, especially, the rents were unsustainable. I mean, you can't have areas that are increasing 20, 30, 40% year over year and have that continue on. So what exactly is the big driver of that NOI either being stagnant or possibly even decreasing as we come up?
Let's slice and dice what you just said. So people felt rent growth was unsustainable in the US. And I think all of those people are correct. But what are those people really saying? Well, hey, rents increasing at 15% a year are unsustainable. Everyone agrees. I agree, and I don't think there's any disagreement. But is that statement the same as rents will decrease? Those are two completely different statements. One of them is right, one of them is wrong. So what we are going to see, and we're already just beginning to see in certain markets, is that the velocity of rent growth is declining. So rents are still growing, but they're growing a lot less fast. And I think that rents in the US can grow at 4, 5, 6% every year without any significant problems. Keep in mind that the last 12 months has seen one of the largest increases in incomes in US history, 5.1%. And unlike the recovery in 2013, this recovery is broad-based. because of the way that money was spread around by the COVID bills, the recovery is broad-based. So the average American today has more money than they did 2 years ago. And also, the wage growth is right around 5% at all levels. So we've seen substantial wage growth. And you might say, yeah, but Neil, how can we get 6% rent growth if there's 5% wage growth? The answer is very simple. Rent is only a small component of the overall spend of Americans. It's one of the biggest, along with gas and food, but it's maybe 24, 26, 28% of the money that people earn goes towards rents. So there's still that remaining money, 60, 65%, that doesn't go towards rent. And what we are seeing today is people are allocating more of those funds to rents as rents go up, because rents are very inflexible. Everyone needs a place to live. So it is actually possible, even at a 10-year, 20-year level, for rents to go up 6% or 7% and incomes to go up 3 to 4% and still for there to be a balance, because people are simply allocating most of the increases in their salary to only two things, to rent and to food. They're not allocating them to vacation. They're not allocating them to investments. As money comes in, more of it goes into rent and food and sometimes to gas. And that's what we are seeing. And so it is normal to see rent growth slow down. So I think we are going to see robust rent growth when we look at the 30-year time frame, which was 2%. We're going to see 4, 5, 6% rent growth going forward. But we are not going to see the kind of rent growth that we saw before because it was truly unsustainable. So hopefully that allows you to really understand what people are saying when they're saying this. You can have a pretty good market, much better than the last 30 years, and still come down 70% from the rent growth that you had last year. So if it was 15% and now it's 5%, you've come down 70% of that growth is lost, but you're still way above the historical trend.
And so I want to point out something that I heard you'd mentioned on another show, and it has to do with those asset classes. I think that the rule of thumb has typically been about a third of your income for housing, whether it's a mortgage or rent.
Yeah, that's a good rule of thumb.
And I've heard that rule of thumb be put around. And you had mentioned on another show that that Class C renter is kind of getting pushed up a little bit more aggressively, where we might have that Class A or that higher income earner who, like you had said, maybe it was 20, 25%. Okay, they're pretty comfortable going up to 28%, 30%, no problem. But that Class C renter is already in that 30. I think the number you had mentioned was about 40% average.
In certain metros. So super hot metros, many of which I invest in, you invest in. So we've heard these names before, right? Dallas and Nashville and Miami and Austin and Phoenix. Those are the metros where the Class C numbers are out of whack now. They're pushing that 37, 38, 40% range. It's different for every metro, where it's really hard to push it further. It's just going to stick around that number and you're going to lose that tenant if you try and push it further. So I think those cities in the Class C realm, we aren't just going to see slowing rent growth. We have seen it already. In the last 12 months, we've had 15% rent growth, so greatest year ever in multifamily history. That's pretty common. But what most people don't know is, unlike the previous 8 years, Class C was lagging. So Class A, Class B were up in that 15%+ range. Class C, 8. So you already see the effect of the people that don't have much money. You can't push them beyond a certain level. Whereas the Class A and Class B renters are around that 24, 25%, where 25% of their income is going to rent. They can push up to 28. They can push up to 31. They can even push up to 35. So we are seeing this separation happen. When we are buying a Class C property, and we still continue to buy those, we're just a lot more careful with rent growth there.
And you said that you still buy Class C property. You still see value there. Is it something that you have tapered off? Do you value more of that Class A or B property instead now because of these metrics that you're talking about? Or are you pretty much staying the course and you're still anticipating, hey, 3 to 4 to 5% growth because you know that's sustainable? And as long as the numbers work at that kind of more sustainable level, you're full speed ahead. Or how have you adjusted your strategy with this data?
So the short answer is I'm really agnostic to Class A, B, or C, but I want to look at every city. There are cities where Class C is hitting that 40% glass ceiling. and I'm no longer willing to buy Class Cs in those markets. But there are other smaller markets where the number is closer to 32 or 33%. And I'll be happy to buy Class C in those markets because I can still increase rents. You look at national numbers, they're an aggregation. There's always a high, there's always a low. And if you can track where the highs are, you can continue to outperform the overall market to a certain level. So I'm continuing to buy C, and I'm buying them in certain areas where there are certain strategies. One, they haven't hit the rent ceiling. The second, which is even more important, is I'm buying in markets that are near superstar markets that have inflated to ridiculous levels. So, like, for example, Austin. Austin is now a Californian city in Texas, $400,000 a unit in multifamily prices. Those are pretty insane levels. And I'm not suggesting that Austin will crash. I'm saying I'm not looking to buy in Austin, but I don't mind buying in Killeen, which is 50 miles from Austin, because I'm buying at $128,000 a unit. Whereas if I was buying today in Austin, I'd be over $400,000 a unit. And history has taught me over the last 30 years that these secondary markets may not be super strong themselves, but as the primary begins to heat or overheat, I'm not suggesting, again, Austin's overheating, but it's very hot, that the investment money tends to trickle down beyond the metro, and it tends to trickle down locally first, and then it goes out of state. So to me, markets like Killeen have great inherent value in the future, even though I'm actually getting a higher cash flow in Killeen today than I would in Austin. I can give you a dozen examples of those kinds of cities where I would love to buy as many Class Cs as are available.
And so it's really putting a lot of emphasis on that income, because I think that's something that's so overlooked, is people will look at cap rates, or they'll look at maybe the cost of a home, or they'll look at interest rates, but they don't really understand the income level that the target tenant has. And can you get 5-6% rent increases over the next couple of years? Or maybe they're already at that ceiling and they're just tapping out. They just can't do it. And so I think that's a really important metric that a lot of people are overlooking. So what do you think right now, given, and I think you've mentioned that this is a market that's just been super, super hot. It brought a lot of people onto this bandwagon of multifamily, which makes it heat up even more. What do you think right now is the greatest threat to multifamily investors?
I'm going to give you a very bland answer to that, but it's also very truthful. The greatest threat to multifamily is that we don't go into a recession. So you might say, that's the greatest threat to multifamily, that we don't go into a recession? The answer is yes. Because today, the Federal Reserve has already said they will do everything they can to fight inflation. And at this point, they need to take the economy into a recession to fight inflation. And that is the only thing that will bring interest rates down. Okay? Most people don't understand this. The Fed's job is to put the economy into a mild recession. They've done it 8 times out of 9 in the last 61 years, into a mild recession. That is the only thing that kills inflation. There is no other fix. That's the Fed's job. They want to take you as close to a recession. In an ideal scenario, they take you all the way to zero growth, and then they start to push it up again. And they do that by cutting interest rates. But usually, it ends up being a mild recession most of the time when you're doing it for inflation reasons. Obviously, 2007 was different. There was something wrong with the economy. I don't see much wrong with the US economy at this point. So the short answer is, the biggest threat to multifamily today is that we don't go into a recession. You might say, the Fed knows how to put us into a recession, but it's really hard. The Federal Reserve in the last 61 years has done this 9 times. Never once have they fought an economy this strong. Today, the average person is getting 5% salary increases. 11 million jobs are open. And the middle class and the lower class is awash with the money that we basically printed and handed to them over the last 24 months. It's actually very difficult to take the economy into a recession. Do you know that in the last 3 months, that is April, May, and June of this year, we actually gained 1.2 million jobs. We're actually pretty happy gaining that many jobs in 6 months, because that's 200,000, which is the benchmark. We are currently gaining jobs at double that speed. The Fed's job is really, really hard. So I do think that they're going to have to raise interest rates many, many times. And if inflation refuses to come down for reasons that have nothing to do with the US, they have everything to do with the price of oil in Europe, then we would be in a tough situation, because on the one side, the Fed is going to beat the economy harder and harder and harder to try and push it down. And on the other side, the price of oil outside the US is going to basically create so much inflation that inflation's not dying. So the Fed's now beating it harder and harder, which makes it harder and harder for multifamily. So strange answer, but true.
No, I think that's an incredible answer because I wasn't anticipating you were going to say this recession that we're in, looming on, whatever the case may be. But I wanted to point that out is because that's really what they're doing. And the Fed knows that they're going to put us into a recession. And a lot of people, when they hear that, they say, oh my God, recession. Why would I buy right now? Why would I invest? Why would I do this, this, and this? Why would I change jobs? And because the word is such a heavy connotation, because I think so many people, their only experience of recession is 08.
Their brain is messed up because we've had 9 recessions, only one that looked like 08 and wasn't a normal recession, right? We had large-scale fraud committed by brokers and by lenders on millions of Americans. So it's nice to look at the last 5 or 6 recessions, and then you realize recessions are part of the normal business cycle. They are necessary. If you don't get recessions, then you run out of opportunity.
I love what you said about the Fed has to step in for this. And if they don't taper this down, if they don't essentially push us into that recession, then they have to fight harder. They have to raise rates more. They have to continue to create this environment where, like you said, they have no experience here, it sounds like, in this type of economy, this type of stronger economy where people are getting...
We have never seen a 180 economy. One side has massively high inflation. Yep. And then on the same time, the economy is so super strong that it's ignoring the inflation. People are simply just paying more money because they still have money left over from those COVID checks. Now, of course, that's a one-time occurrence. That money will run out. We've already seen those numbers shrink from 5 trillion to 2 trillion. Mm-hmm. We've still got another year before we return to 2019 size bank balances for Americans. So God knows how long the economy can fight the Fed.
So you're excited for this because you feel it's going to kind of return us to that normalcy. And you think this is really healthy for multifamily investors and not something that they should be afraid of.
I think that there should be short-term fear because interest rates could go up beyond what people are looking at. So if you have a lot of properties coming up for renewal right now that haven't been doing well, you should be worried. Luckily, the vast majority of the multifamily market, almost all of them, have seen the greatest increase in rents in history. So if you were holding a property over the last 18 months and you were part of that one-time lifetime bonanza, your property did see a very significant increase in profit. So even as you are going into this point where you have to refinance and pay more, you shouldn't be upside down, which is why I feel this concept of multifamily will crash and burn is silly. Because if everyone in the last year has had incredible profits, who's going to let their property go? Who's going to be that person that is upside down? There's almost nobody upside down, but obviously our profits are going to be hurt as we pay more on interest than we did before. So it's going to shrink our profits. It's going to shrink our cash flow. But on the other side, here's the part that most people don't think about. You've got to look at both sides. So if the Fed does its job and puts the economy into a mild recession, which is their job, guess what the Fed does every single time after they realize the economy is in a recession? They cut rates. We are artificially putting the economy into a recession. We're forcing it into a recession. It doesn't want to go there. We're pushing it down. But the Fed doesn't just push down. They push down, then they push up. Mm-hmm. So guess what happens to rates whenever the economy goes into a recession? You start seeing rate cutting cycles, and that brings prices down. This allows the cycle to start again and creates more opportunity for us a year or 2 years down the line. That's what I'm excited about. The key is to just get through the next 12 months of choppiness with short-term bridge loans. I highly advise that no one lock in fixed rates at this point in time because there's no evidence that rates will stay this high. In fact, the US economy does not function well when rates are this high. The Fed knows that. Obviously, they're a very data-driven organization. So if you go back 61 years and look at the last 9 interest rate hiking cycle, you notice that all 9 have something in common. Rates sharp up, rates sharp down. Find me one incident in the last 61 years where the Fed raised rates and then just decided to do nothing. It doesn't happen.
There's a lot of those graphs going around right now. And anybody who's kind of in this space has probably seen them where they'll say these gray lines are recessions. And then you'll have a line of the rates. And of course they raise, put us into it, then they lower at the end. And again, kind of putting us through that cycle. And so I love all the information. It's so valuable because there's so many people who just don't know what to think right now. And they don't have the ability to absorb the kind of data and information like guys like you especially have. And so with all this information, with all this going on, are you sticking to multifamily, or are there other asset classes that interest you maybe because of these different circumstances?
For the moment, it's multifamily for a number of reasons. So in the past, I have been asset class agnostic. So of all syndicators that are on your show, I'm pretty sure I'm the one that has the most number of asset classes under my belt. So I've got student housing, built to rent, townhomes for sale. I've got industrial, self-storage, and of course, multifamily. In the past, many times, if you watch my podcast from 3 or 4 years ago, I was telling people, go out and buy industrial. It's really awesome asset class. I was telling people, go out and buy self-storage. I did so myself as well, even though I probably ended up still buying more multifamily than anything else.
Sure.
Today, though, that situation is problematic. I find that industrial is still extremely hot, red hot, and is a little bit too red hot. I'm not recommending it at this point of time. That may change in the future. I think it's seen a massive increase in prices because of e-commerce growth after COVID. So these are both asset classes that are doing well. But when I look at everything being expensive, all things being equal, I'll still take multifamily. So at this point, I'm not recommending any asset class other than multifamily. I do know of one asset class that's significantly better than multifamily, but it's not available to most people, either that are syndicators or investing in syndicators, build to rent. If you ask the people that have billions and the people that have tens of billions, it's not even close. If you ask 100 of them, is BTR better or multifamily? 95 will give you BTR, 5 will give you multifamily. It's not even close. The challenge is BTR is not easily available. So in the absence of that, multifamily still remains the first choice. You just have to be careful how much you're paying, because I assure you the price you'll pay 3 months from today on a per door basis is lower than what you're paying today. It has to happen.
Are you waiting right now because of that?
I'm mostly waiting. As I mentioned, there are some exceptions, tertiary markets where I can find prices that are still very low. So today in Austin, you have to pay $400,000 a door in most cases. But in Killeen, I bought a property earlier this year at $128,000 a unit. And it's brick. It's 80s built. It's in great condition. If I can find an asset like that today, I'll execute. But otherwise, yes, Justin, I'm just going to sit and wait.
Let's say you're sitting and waiting now, and you had kind of thrown out 3 months from now. Is there a certain signal that you're waiting for? Something the Fed's going to do, something they're going to say. So that's going to signal to you, okay, now it's time for me to start getting back in the game and get a little bit more aggressive.
I think the answer is straightforward. Today, what's happening to projects is people are bidding on them and paying a certain price, and then they're having trouble getting financing to work. And so they're either going back and raising more equity, which is always bad because you lower your returns, or they're taking mezzanine loans, or they're taking risky short-term loans. And so you're seeing evidence of all of that stuff. So that shows that there's a gap in the market between what people are paying and what they should be paying. So right now, we're often not in best and final. We're a million or two off. When that market adjusts to where we are 100,000 or 200,000 off, which is a normal market, well, then you start buying again, because at that point in time, it's a natural purpose. I'm not stopping making offers. We made 6 offers in the last 2 weeks. We're just not getting anywhere close. Once the market readjusts and becomes normal, we'll start getting close. And I think it's an automatic process that we will start buying, because we never really stopped making offers.
So you're not stopping the activity, but naturally you're going to start getting more chance at that. You're going to get into best and finals, and you're going to be closer. And then the properties and the owners who were blowing off your offers last month, now they're saying, hey, are you still interested in this property? So I love that. You're not being active, but you're just naturally going to figure out when you're hitting the mark a lot more.
The brokers still need to see you making active offers. And you want to be second or third, because what I'm seeing is, number one, retrading happening. So retrading activity in Q3 is going to be 5, 6, 10 times higher than it was in Q2, because people realize, oh, I overpaid for this property and now the lender is refusing to give me a loan. So they go back and talk to the seller and say, hey, I want to retrade this property and I want to pay $1 million less. Now, sometimes the buyer's like, hey, I got $200,000 of your deposit, I'll just keep the deposit, goodbye. But the buyers also know what's happening. They know why the seller is coming back. they know that the next guy is going to have the exact same problem. Yep. So many times they're like, okay, I'm sorry, I can't give you the property for $1 million less. They go to the second person who was willing to give them $500,000 less, and they go and say, I'll give you the property. So now they've kept the other guy's $200,000, and now they've gotten half of what the other guy was willing to retrade for. The other guy said, give me $1 million discount. Well, the second person, which could be me or could be Justin, is now saying, yeah, I'll give you $500,000 discount. So that still ends up to be a pretty good scenario for sellers. And we are going to see lots of that, lots of that. So I want to be that second guy or third guy that didn't get the property.
That's really, really incredible insight. I mean, I think anybody who is in the multifamily space or the investment space in general, no matter what their level of seasonality, is going to get a ton of value out of this episode and will continue to get value out of you. I know I study you and all the episodes you put out very, very closely. So Neil, how can people get a hold of you, and what's the best way for people maybe to get in touch?
That really depends on what they're looking for. So I happen to be the only Neil Bawa on the World Wide Web. So if you simply type in N-E-A-L space B-A-W-A and hit enter into Google, I think the first 500 entries are all going to be me. So in that 500 entries, there's probably 200 podcasts, a couple hundred conferences, presentations that they have on the web. There's articles, there's various websites that my content is on. So that's one way of doing it. But if you want to be more specific and you want something that's more timely, the best way to do it is multifamilyu.com. So if you go to the website multifamily followed by the letter u.com, we do 15 data-driven presentations. We do them for our investors. We have 800 active investors. So we do the presentations for them. And then when we're done, we stick them on this website called multifamilyu.com. So you're welcome to come and watch them on demand. And I think the one that makes the most sense right now is a presentation. It's about 45 minutes long with 45 minutes of Q&A. About 1,000 people watched it. It's called The Impact of Interest Rates and Inflation on Real Estate. So it's a longer chart and graph-driven version of this podcast. So it'll elaborate on everything we've touched today and maybe a few other items that we didn't get a chance to talk about today.
Perfect. Listeners, we're going to put links there to Multifamily U in the show notes. Definitely check it out. It is an incredible resource. You know, puts in a ton of work into these and consolidates all the information and gives you the very, very best of the best. So I'm a big fan personally. I'm excited to have you on the show. Neil, thank you so much for coming on. This has been fantastic.
Thanks, Justin.